You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Veterinarians touch every aspect of our lives, from the moment we wake up to the time we close our eyes at night. They keep the food that we eat safe, the pets in our lives healthy, and monitor the health of the environment by keeping an eye on the animals that inhabit it. One area of veterinary concern that many people are not aware of is aquatic veterinary medicine. My guest today, Dr. Roy Yanong, will immerse us in knowledge regarding veterinary involvement from industrial fish production to serving the needs of the fish hobbyist. We'll be right back after this short break with Dr. Roy.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hey, ready to take a walk? Not just you, but the whole family. It's the 2009 Whisker Walk, Sunday, June 7th from 11 to 3 at the Lancaster Fairground in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Pet owners and animal lovers walk to lend a paw to benefit the animal shelters and pet charities they love. Come see exhibits, demonstrations, educational programs, special attractions, product giveaways, entertainment, auctions, raffles, food, fun, and things for adults and kids to see, do, and buy, both human and pet-related. Whisker Walk 2009, a fun day for everyone. For more information, log on to whiskerwalk.org.
Hi, this is Marcy Davis and my service dog Whistle, and we're your hosts of Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Working Like Dogs is the show where you can learn everything you ever wanted to know about working animals or working dogs. Whether you're a member of a working dog team, or you've just seen a working dog or animal out at the mall or the grocery store, and you're curious about how these amazing animals work with their human partners, then Working Like Dogs is the show for you. Join us for the inside scoop at Working Like Dogs on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Roy, thank you so much for being with us. I have to admit, I know little to nothing about fish medicine. Is this a fairly new aspect of veterinary medicine?
Actually, it isn't really too new, but I think there's been more awareness over the past maybe decade or so. There have been veterinarians involved probably since about the 80s, but within the past 10, 15 years, there's been a real large jump in interest, both on the veterinary side as well as in the side of the pet owner as well as the aquaculture industry.
I find, looking at your background, that it's very unusual. Number one, that you have a Bachelor of Arts in molecular biophysics, and physics was one of those areas that I did not especially enjoy. And then you add on top of that biochemistry, and something I had to take from Yale. Then you went into studying leukemia in soft shell clams in Boston. Now, leukemia in clams, I would have said, if somebody asked me that million-dollar question, do clams get leukemia? And I would say, no. Tell us about a little bit of that study before we get into the rest of this.
Sure, sure. And actually, yeah, my whole background was kind of was interesting. I was looking at human medicine to start with, and had looked at that and maybe possibly doing some research. And that was real interesting, that field. I'm really kind of into that, sort of the really fine detail sort of thing. It was much more than I really wanted to do, and I was much more interested in animals to begin with. So I ended up really pursuing veterinary medicine. The clam work I did was with some of the researchers over at Tufts that were looking at a potential tie between pollution in the harbor in around Boston and this basically blood tumor in these clams. And it was something that was being looked at back then, which was, I guess, the mid to late 80s, which I didn't actually realize that they got this sort of a tumor or a leukemia either at that time. So it was something I was learning at the same time. But it was pretty interesting. I ended up doing field samples at about 4 sites every month during blizzards, during low tides, as low as I could get to give me enough time to collect. And we ended up getting pretty good information. I would bleed the clams. We would look for basically a large number of blood cells that were abnormal on slides, and then try to correlate that with some of the findings they were looking at with regard to some pollution. But it looked like, at least when I recall, because that was a while ago, that it was most likely due to some sort of viral problem versus a direct link with pollution at that time.
I think a lot of people will find that really fascinating, that studying something like, they think, a clam, how can that affect human health, or how can these animals be used as possibly sentinels to see what's going on in the environment? If these clams are getting ill, can that possibly be as one of the first indicators that people may be getting ill? And veterinarians really are involved in that, aren't they?
Exactly. And yeah, great point, Brendan. I think one of the big pushes for the medical professions, both veterinary and human, is kind of looking at a One Health sort of vision where everything is really interconnected, whether it's, you know, environmental, water quality, air pollution, that sort of thing. There are definitely a lot of species that, of course, we as veterinarians work with, but that are directly related or have maybe some susceptibility to certain things that humans may be affected by as well. And so definitely a lot of work has been done looking at different aquatic animals as bioindicators for different types of problems, and the a lot of the bivalves, the clams, oysters, etc. A lot of people look at those because they really do filter a lot of water, and many times they're going to be concentrating things that might be a problem.
I remember last July went to New Orleans for the American Veterinary Medical Association's National Convention, and there in the French Quarter, one of the delicacies is having clams. And there is a lot of concern about all the pollution that was going down the Mississippi as to whether or not it was really appropriate for people to eat these raw oysters and the raw clams. What's your view on eating raw fish?
Well, I have to admit, I'm a fish lover in many ways, and I love raw fish and raw clams or raw oysters. So I definitely enjoy that. And in terms of raw fish, obviously there, you know, it's quite a bit of work that's been done by FDA and the other agencies in terms of trying to make sure things are done, and USDA, to make sure things are done as healthfully as possible for folks. And then there's going to be a lot of common sense approach to people. If there's a situation where there may be some sketchy food put out in front of you, and you don't think it looks quite as good, or if you don't have you don't know the reputation of the place you're at, then you know that would be, I think, kind of a common sense thing. But I think for different groups of people, different age groups, you know, there's always considerations for pregnant women, et cetera, that sort of thing, for various types of potential compounds in some of these. As well as potential, you know, bacteria, et cetera, that people have to be aware of. I think overall it's probably not, being who I am and having eaten a lot of raw things in my life, maybe I developed some kind of strong
immunity
against it, exactly. But I think overall, you know, there's quite a few people that do. And you know, again, there's probably going to be some variation in how people handle it and as well as you know, where you go. But overall, I think it's fine as long as things are done, obviously, properly and people use common sense.
Something that you touched on, and I think, again, people may not be aware of, we think of, all right, our milk being produced, the bacon that we eat, the hamburgers that we eat, the meat that is out there, the red meat, maybe even, you know, chickens. Veterinarians are involved in the production, the health aspects, overseeing that the animals that are used in production are going to be healthy. But veterinarians are also involved in fish production. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. And there's more veterinarians getting involved now. Traditionally, there's been a lot of fish pathologists and other non-veterinary folks that have done quite a bit to advance that field. And over the years, there's been a greater kind of influx of veterinarians working with these folks as well as with production in general. So there is much more work now by veterinarians working with aquaculture producers, as you say, trying to make sure that the fish are healthy on the, you know, on the production side as well.
And fish are no longer just being harvested from the oceans. They truly have fish farms. And if I remember correctly, I read someplace recently that, like in the middle of the desert someplace, they had set up these fish farms for a certain type of fish that would thrive in that type of environment.
Yeah, and that's actually, there's quite a few different places that do produce fish. There's a lot of different, maybe kind of niche sort of environments where there may be a warm water, spring or something in some of the colder states where they're able to raise fish that they wouldn't normally be able to raise. Or there may be either technology or other things that allow for fish to be produced in certain areas that wouldn't normally be there. But there is definitely an increase. As you mentioned, there's a lot more production of aquaculture. I think there's actually going to be a PBS documentary as well coming up on looking at aquaculture in the next couple of weeks or so. But there is a great demand for seafood, you know, both freshwater as well as marine seafood by the human population, which continues to grow. And the ability for the oceans and the lakes and the natural bodies of water to fulfill the great need is really, really pretty limited. So aquaculture has played a large role in trying to help to meet the need. And I think, depending on who you speak to, there's an expectation that it'll take over, and it has actually taken over a lot of that need already, you know, whether we're talking fish or some of the invertebrate-type foods like shrimp and clams, et cetera.
Well, Dr. Rohr, you've had a very varied career so far. After leaving veterinary school, you got involved in an ornamental fish production. Is that correct? And what does that mean?
Yes, exactly. Well, I've always been a pretty avid fish hobbyist. When I was a little kid, I remember the first fish I had, we went to the store. I was, I think, in third grade. We thought they were trying to scam us by telling us that we should buy a tank and filters and all the things that you really need for a good aquarium, but we thought they were just trying to scam us to buy more supplies from them. So I ended up telling them we had an aquarium already and I just wanted to buy a fish and I needed a small bowl. So I bought a fish, had a small bowl that I put it in, and it died after maybe 4 days. So that was kind of my introduction to fish, the hobby and the industry. I actually hopefully learned a lot more since then. And after thinking about it in vet school and being really interested in just the ornamental hobby for many years, I actually actively sought a position working with the industry. And I had a colleague of mine, Dr. Greg Lubart, who was working down here with an importer as well as a wholesaler of ornamental fish, who let me know about a fish farm that was looking at hiring somebody. So, you know, I jumped at the chance, came down, interviewed. They offered me the job, and it was actually a really eye-opening for me to see how fish are produced. I think a lot of folks don't know where fish in the pet stores really come from and how they're bred and grown out. And to really see all the variety of species that are involved, learn their names, you know, maybe not their personal names, but at least the names of the species, and then kind of really work actively with the folks on the production side to see how it's really done. Was very, very great learning experience for me, and really kind of a different aspect of veterinary medicine. You know, a lot of folks are familiar with kind of the pet side, but this is sort of a combination of pet as well as the agricultural sort of production side of veterinary medicine, which is also really important.
I think a lot of people would think, okay, you go to the store, the pet store, and there's a goldfish. Well, I guess there's a goldfish farm someplace because you probably can't get that out of the wild. But looking at some of the saltwater fish and some of those really gorgeous fish, I think a lot of people think, well, they just go to the Caribbean and they put down their net and they bring up these fish and then it somehow ends up at the pet store. I gather that's not correct.
Well, that's actually kind of correct and kind of not correct. There's a huge sort of chain of interlocking entities that kind of get the fish to the store, and it will vary a lot on species. So there's definitely a great number of species in the freshwater side of the hobby that are produced both on farms here in, you know, Florida and in other parts of the U.S. as well as overseas, as well as actually some marine species as well, not quite as many as the freshwater by any means, but a fair number, and that's been increasing over time. And then there's a lot of wild fish that are collected, as you kind of describe, and there are going to be kind of different mechanisms by which those wild fish that are caught are going to be sort of go through the ranks to end up in the pet store. So in some cases, there may be more direct links. There might be a large wholesale operation that has a direct site where they collect, and so there may be kind of a shorter number of steps before it gets in the store. And then there may be some where it's going to be collected in the wild. It'll be held at an importer, exporter in one area, moved to another central one, you know, near the airport of a certain country. It'll be brought over to an importer, exporter in the U.S., and then it gets to the pet store. So there's going to be kind of a variation on sort of how the fish end up getting into the store, depending on a lot of different factors.
I know there's concern about taking some wild animals, for instance, reptiles from the wild, and bringing these snakes, lizards, whatever, into our pet stores, that, you know, say hundreds would be collected, and then the numbers that would actually make it to the pet store would be minuscule in comparison. And then so many of those within a year or so, oh, they died. Okay, let's just get ourselves another one. And the impact that that wild capture was actually having on the environment. Could you kind of address that a bit?
Sure. And that's definitely, you know, that's definitely a very important consideration of something that needs to be looked into. And over the past, you know, 15, 20 years, there's been a number of groups trying to address that. There was a group that was looking at a lot of the marine fish are actually collected. You know, obviously, many people are familiar with the kind of older means by which people used to use cyanide and the problems with that, as well as you mentioned, kind of the numbers game where you may have a small percentage making it. So one of the entities that has been looking at it recently, I think, was the Marine Aquarium Council. They tried to develop some regs. I think there's, you know, to try to make sure folks are doing it well. And a lot of the wholesalers at this point, you know, many of them affiliated with some of the large store outlets, will try to have some sort of regulations. It actually becomes kind of an economic bottom line as well as an environmental concern, because, you know, obviously there's a push for sustainability of collection for the folks on the collection side, because their livelihood will depend on it. And in many of these cases, too, there is some overlap with ecotourism. So for many reasons, many of these places, you know, there is a kind of an important sort of codependence on the fact that there is sustainability there. And then on the other side, if fish don't make it and they, you know, they spend a lot of money to get them over, then they're going to be losing money as well. So, you know, it's kind of evolving. There are many folks trying to look at that. And as I mentioned, and as you're probably aware, a lot of it does come down to economics as well as, obviously, you know, looking for the environment. But a lot of things are economically driven. So I think there is definitely pushes for trying to kind of merge those two among different entities, whether they're non-profit organizations like some of these involved with wildlife in general, or others that are, you know, on the commercial side.
Speaking of economics, all of a sudden you decide that, you know, you're young, you're in third grade, and you're going to get your fish. And you thought that they were just kind of trying to fleece you by, you needed the filter, you needed this, you needed that. And oftentimes people aren't aware of, what do I need in order to set up an aquarium? I always tell people when they're going to be getting a pet, and I guess this also, it does have to go for fish, that when you get them, it's for life. Their life, and you want that life to be as long as it should be. And too many times you get the sick fish, you go, oh, it's sick. You know, how do you know it's sick until it's upside down and you flush it down the toilet? I think we should take a short little break, but when we come back, I'd love to have you address, how do you do your homework? Where do you go? And how should you set up that first aquarium? And how do you know if your fish is sick? So we'll be right back after this short break with Dr. Roy Yanong, and he'll be telling us about how to keep your fish healthy. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Planet am I on?
Welcome to Pet Planet. Here's a copy of Pet Planet magazine, Florida's most informative and fun pet resource magazine. It features heartwarming stories and informative articles from local and national pet experts.
Excellent.
Pet Planet magazine offers Operation Planet Rescue, helping rescued pets find new homes. And it's available at 500 locations in South and Central Florida and 24/7 on the internet at petplanetmagazine.com. If you're out and about with your pet, you may be featured in paparazzi, candid pictures of you and your pet,
For up-to-date pet-friendly events, activities, and pet-related services and products, Pet Planet Magazine is your final destination.
I shall take this magazine home with me.
Back to your home planet?
No, to my condo in Boca.
Pet Planet Magazine. Check them out at www.petplanetmagazine.com or 352-394-8578. It's out of this world.
Coast to coast and around the world, it's All Behave with Arden Moore. Find out why cats and dogs do the things they do and get the latest buzz from wagging tongues and tails in Rin Tin Tinseltown. From famous pet experts and best-selling authors to television and movie stars, you'll get great tail-wagging pet tips and have a fur-flying fun time. All Behave with America's pet edutainer, Arden Moore. Every week on demand, this is the place for a special paparazzi treat. Only on PetLifeRadio.com. Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
So, Dr. Roy, we've decided that we are going to be the fish hobbyist, and we want to have this wondrous tank of fish in our homes. How do we decide what's the best fish for us? Where do we get them, and how do we keep them healthy?
That's a great question, and I think there are so many folks, at least I know when I was growing up, and we're hoping obviously for the industry that, you know, continues, that realize the beauty and all the intricacies and science and pleasure of having an aquarium in their home or, you know, office. There's a lot of considerations that need to be made when you're looking into that. One big one is obviously purpose. You know, if it's for your home, are you looking at it as something that's maybe going to be also educational for the kids? Is it something that you want to be sort of ornamental in the you know, area you're going to place it in? Another major consideration is cost, and also who's going to be maintaining it. Many folks will try to set this up for maybe a learning experience for their children, and hopefully they realize at some point they're going to be taking it over. But you know, those considerations are pretty important, as well as things like size, space, where it's going to be located. Those are all things that need to be looked into. With some of that information, you're going to have a better idea, for example, in terms of size for an aquarium, what type of fish to get. And I think your philosophy is very good when you're talking to anyone who wants to be a pet owner, whether it's a dog, cat, bird, or fish, is that you're sort of in charge of this animal, and you need to really do all you can to keep it alive as long as possible and as healthy as possible. So knowing what types of fish you're kind of interested in, you have to do a little homework. The pet stores, if you go to some of the good pet stores, you know, you should get some good information in terms of what the animals are, which fish have really specific needs, which ones are a little more easy to take care of. Also, how big they get, you know, real important to know that. If you have a tank that's going to be too small for them and, you know, in about 6 months, then that's probably not a good fish for you.
Who gets along well with who?
Exactly, and compatibility, exactly. You don't want to put a big Oscar cichlid that likes to eat little tiny neon tetras together with neon tetras, because they'll all disappear after a couple of days. So you definitely want the compatibility taken care of. And now, freshwater is a really good type of tank to start with, and many people will do fish only where they don't have plants involved. Plants are sort of another thing which I actually really like in my tanks, but they will require a little bit more kind of input in order to do them properly.
So it's okay to cheat and use plastic plants?
Sure, definitely. And for folks that have never had an aquarium before, they really probably want to make things as easy as possible. Now, one of the other things they need to do is make sure that they are aware of what their water quality is in terms of their tap water, if they're going to use that. Obviously, many places use chlorine or chloramines. They're going to have to be familiar with how to get rid of that so the fish don't die, because they don't do well with that type of water. And then also have a good test kit to test water quality parameters. And some of the real important ones include ammonia, nitrate, pH, and obviously a thermometer for temperature. There's many other things that they should be checking, but at least ammonia, nitrate, pH and temperature, they should have a good idea, because those things are going to be things that may kill their fish pretty quickly if the water gets out of whack.
So is water the most common reasons why fish get sick?
Definitely. And again, for folks that are beginning in aquaria or beginning in the hobby, they don't quite understand the length of time it takes for some of the major biological filtration to occur within an aquarium. Kind of like in an open body of water like a pond, there's a lot of bacteria in there that will break down some of the byproducts of fish. Basically, a big one that's important is ammonia. Ammonia is the product that comes out of fish after they eat protein, kind of like, you know, when we make our urine, basically, we've got byproducts of our protein digestion in there. So fish actually make ammonia. It comes out of their gills, so we kind of tell folks that basically fish primarily pee out of their gills. Kind of a good visual for people. But that ammonia is really toxic. And so if it gets high or if there's any really even small level of that, the fish will die. And so all the bacteria eventually will set up a kind of a factory where the bacteria will break that ammonia down into nitrite and then nitrate, into other compounds that are not as harmful to the fish. That
so some bacteria is good.
Exactly. There's definitely bacteria that are, we call them biofilter bacteria, or nitrifying bacteria, and those are part of nature. And many times they'll basically just turn up in a tank over a period of time, whether it's maybe on the fish or potentially if people bring plants in or other animals into the system, or they'll just eventually appear. But some folks actually will use different things you can buy from the store that have bacteria in them that will start your biofilter. So some bacteria definitely are necessary in order to keep your fish alive, and being able to check your ammonia and nitrite as that process occurs is very important, because that's definitely the number one reason people lose fish within the first couple of weeks of having an aquarium.
And there's simple tests that you can do, or do you take your water to the pet store and say, here's my water, test it for me?
Yeah, many pet stores will do that, but it's really good for many reasons for you to be able to do that. And a lot of test kits are available at pet stores to test for those real basic but important parameters. And if you have set up a tank, we usually tell people at least every day or every couple of days to test for those specific parameters until they basically get the readings that are good and let them know that the bacteria have taken over. And that's another thing, too, is when you set up an aquarium, you don't want to get, 100 fish all at once or 10 fish all at once. You kind of want to get a few at a time so that your bacteria can kind of build up slowly and you don't introduce a lot of that ammonia into the system all at once. But what that means also then is that if you do get multiple groups of fish in, that you have to be careful, because if you have one group of fish in there and then you throw in another group maybe a couple weeks later, there's always a potential that they have different types of things kind of on them, maybe whether they're bacteria or parasites, and they may infect each other. So that's kind of another twist to it you've got to consider. And that's getting a little more complicated, but there are other things to consider when you're kind of getting your tank going.
What would be some signs that you have sick fish, besides, the oop is upside down and it's dead? How do you know it's sick before it gets to that point?
Well, a lot of times if you put your ear up to the aquarium, you can kind of hear them sort of complaining, They'll may talk to each other and tell each other how bad they feel. Since that doesn't really happen, obviously, there's just like with any of the animals, and like even your dog or cat, one of the big initial things that you look for is, are they eating? Many times fish will stop eating if something's wrong. So that's something real important. Another is behavior. So if you're, for example, if your dog starts kind of moving around in a circle, which is not something that it would normally do, then there's something going on, or else it's chasing its tail or something. But with fish, if they're swimming, you've been observing them for a couple of days or a week, and you know that they normally swim in the middle of the water of the tank, but you go in the next day and you notice they're all in the bottom, or all at the top, that's another thing to look for. Often, too, you may see their fins starting to look a little more ratty, or they may develop things on their body that, don't look normal. So, again, it's real important for the pet owner to be able to look at the fish, know what a normal fish in that group should look like and where they normally behave and swim, and obviously know what they should be eating and be aware of when they stop eating. Those are real good indicators.
If I look at my fish and say, this just doesn't look healthy, I think most people, the first thing they'll do is go to their pet store. I have a feeling you're going to tell us, no, they should really go to their veterinarian who's involved in aquaculture. How do you find them? Are there many of you out there?
Yeah, and that's actually, and that's kind of a good question. There are definitely, you know, with my job working as an extension vet with the aquaculture folks, we get a lot of calls from, actually from hobbyists that are trying to find a local vet to work with them. And in some places, there are a lot of vets, especially exotic type vets who work with, you know, pocket pets or birds or reptiles who will also work with fish. But in some parts of the U.S., it's actually pretty difficult to find. And there's a couple ways that they can try to do that. And definitely, they can get some good information on husbandry, et cetera, from pet stores. But I think when it comes to fish health, ideally, you know, if possible, they would want to try to work with a veterinarian or, you know, at least talk to a veterinarian. One of the things that we've done through the AVMA is we've developed one website, which is aquavetmed.info, which is still kind of in progress. It's actually pretty good right now, but we're hoping to improve it and kind of get it a little more cleaned up. But at this point, there's quite a bit of information on there with regard to veterinarians that work with clients that have fish. So there's kind of a search engine to look for folks within your state. Another avenue I would recommend is, again, either going through the white pages or yellow pages looking for veterinarians that see exotic animals. A lot of times those people, especially if they work with herps and birds, may work with fish as well. And then a third way would be to contact the State Veterinary Medical Association and, you know, ask them if they have any folks that they know of that work with fish or would work with fish. So there's a couple of ways. A lot of times it may be word of mouth, but if you at least try to pursue those avenues, you hopefully will get a bite. And one of the things we do too, also, because there are more vets getting involved, but still, as with even food animal practice, there's areas that don't have the veterinarians in those areas. We also will often work with veterinarians who are maybe comfortable with some exotics, but maybe just want a little bit of, you know, want to be able to get some advice from folks that do see fish a little more often. So if there's a veterinarian locally that is interested in working with you, if they can hook up with a veterinarian maybe elsewhere as kind of a consultant, a lot of times that's another way that actually you can get a lot of work done and a really good outcome for your fish.
I've been surprised going to pet stores and going through the fish areas. There's all these various antibiotics and tonics and drops and things that you can put in the water that looks like it cures everything. What are some of the problems associated with getting these over-the-counter medications?
Right, and that's very true. There's a lot of products available that you can see that do cure, you know, or propose to cure everything, and hopefully folks kind of make the connection that, well, you know, there's really typically not products out there for dogs or cats or people that cure everything, so it's not necessarily going to be the same, or you would think it would be the same for fish. There are, you know, there's nothing that really cures all. It's very difficult many times to know what's in some of these products if they don't actually give the ingredients on the label. And, you know, again, that's another really good reason to try to work with a veterinarian to help sort of figure that out and know what really you should be doing to begin with. A lot of times folks do go to the store, see something that kind of cures everything, throws it in the tank without knowing exactly what they're putting in the tank, and then by the time a veterinarian actually is contacted, the fish or the aquarium has been through multiple treatments, and the fish may be affected by the treatments as well as the initial disease. So definitely a little bit more tricky when you try to do things without having a good idea what the actual problem is and without knowing what ingredients you're actually putting in your tank.
Speaking of something tricky that I know veterinarians do, and this is where I have absolute amazement at what can be done, veterinarians can actually do surgery on fish. How do you put a fish under anesthesia? How do you do surgery on a fish, and why?
It's funny you say that because a lot of times when I'm speaking with folks, that's sort of a shocker for them, is that actually people can do fish surgery. And there are actually quite a few vets out there, a lot of private practitioners who, as well as, you know, us researchers and us working with, you know, folks working in the public aquaria that do surgery with fish. It's really not as crazy or difficult as you may think. There's a couple anesthetics people use real commonly. One is called trichine methane sulfonate, which actually is put in the water, and at the right dose with a buffer solution, the fish will actually get knocked out and kind of go to sleep, as it were, over a relatively short period of time. Depending on what needs to be done surgically, the fish can either be kind of kept in that solution and then just pulled out you know, if it's maybe a small removal of a mass or something externally, you know, that can be done real quickly, and then the fish can be recovered in a tank of fresh water. Or if it's more advanced, and you know, some, you are asking why, there are a couple different, well, not a couple, very, very many different reasons you might need to do a prolonged surgery. There may be, with some of the koi folks, sometimes these koi will get tumors in their body cavity, so maybe like some gonadal type tumors or some other type of cancers that have to be removed. And so vets will open them up, have to take them out of the water many times, a number of our colleagues have developed pretty nice kind of machines essentially that will pump water through the fish's gills as it's out of the water. Because if you think about it, it's kind of like us being in water, we need to have some sort of access to air. Fish being out of water need access to water so that they can breathe through their gills. So basically, they'll have some sort of a mechanism by which water is pumped over their gills with the anesthetic in it that will keep the fish under, basically under anesthesia until the surgery is completed. Then the vets will just basically sew them up like they would any other animal, and you know, the fish should be good to go depending on what the problem was.
On another note, as we finish this up, I am a person who's had a aquarium, say, and all of a sudden I realize, you know, I just don't want these fish anymore. It's just too much hassle. I don't want them. Do I just flush them down the toilet, take them to my local stream, and let them loose? What should a person do if they decide, you know, I don't want these fish any longer?
That is another great question. And unfortunately, Nemo, I think, kind of gave folks the wrong idea, although it was a great movie. But flushing down the toilet is not a very good idea, nor is releasing them into the environment. There are a couple possibilities, and it really sort of depends on a number of factors. But if, in many cases, there may be local aquarium societies, and I was pretty active and remain active with some of the societies in our area here that have a lot of folks that are very into fish. You know, I know some of these guys have maybe, you know, 50 to 100 or so tanks, and you know, do a really good job of keeping them. And many of these guys will adopt fish. So if you have a local aquarium society, you might be able to find one of them to actually take the fish from you. There may be pet stores that are willing to take them back if they're, you know, if they're a nice fish, either in trade or you know, keep them and sell them off. If you don't find an avenue for it, whether it's, you know, adoption through somebody else or, you know, giving it to someone you know who has an aquarium, another option would be trying to work with somebody who, you know, contacting the veterinarian. There's ways that you can euthanize your pet fish that are relatively quick, and you know, a good way also to sort of take care of that without too much of a problem. There are potential problems if you do release them into the wild, and there's a number of folks that are involved with a program called Habitattitude, I think it's called. I keep forgetting the actual name for it, but basically there's, because of potential problems with getting non-native species into areas that where they may potentially cause problems, it's really important to not release fish into the wild. So try to do one of those other things we mentioned if you can, and if not, contact a veterinarian and try to see if there's another way to approach it.
Well, you have given us just some fascinating information, some great information. So hopefully if people have some interest in having pet fish, the website that you mentioned is going to be listed on our website. If you have questions about fish, ask your own veterinarian, ask your state veterinary medical association, or go to this website, because this is a fascinating way of keeping a little bit of nature in your home. We've been speaking today with Dr. Roy Yanong. He is a veterinarian who is passionate about fish medicine and a veterinarian who's one of few. So thank you very much for being with us today. The hope of the show is to always educate and entertain. I think we did both of that today. Questions, ask your own veterinarian, or you can always email me at thepetdoctor@petliferadio.com. Come back again next week. We'll have some more fascinating information for you. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.